The military judge abused his discretion. His basis for reaching that extreme remedy rested on several erroneous interpretations of both the law and the facts of the case. At the outset, it's somewhat difficult to determine exactly why the military judge dismissed the case with prejudice, since he cites a number of legal concepts in his post hoc findings of fact and conclusions of law that were submitted 17 full days after the United States' notice of appeal.
Counsel, can I just ask a procedural question? Is the government prepared to turn over these notes if this case goes back to trial?
If the case goes back to trial and this court orders that, and assuming we don't appeal it to the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, then we would have no choice at that point to turn the notes over, Your Honor.
Let me clarify that. So the military judge had several remedies at his disposal if he found a wrong was committed here. But if evaded the proceedings, could have dismissed without prejudice, he would, of course, dismiss with prejudice. If we were to send it back, and the military judge, and perhaps merely find fault with the military judge's choice of remedy, the military judge should have evaded the proceedings, let's say, instead of dismissed with prejudice. At that point, only on the issue of remedy would we send it back. Is the, government now it should turn over those notes to the military judge? Is it willing to do so? Does it agree that that was proper to do here?
Well, Your Honor, it's kind of two prongs, or at least two prongs. So in his findings of fact and conclusions of law, he cites a number of different reasons or justifications, we would classify them as, why he dismissed with prejudice. Number one, he cites a bad faith invocation of the attorney work product doctrine. Number two, he cites alleged Brady violations. Number three, he alleges a violation of the accused's speedy trial right. So again, it's difficult to determine exactly why he did dismiss. Now, if this court does decide on a narrow ground that he was improper in not granting a continuance, which the United States, which the trial counsel asked for, actually pleaded with the judge and asked for, if this court is inclined just to grant on that narrow ground, then it could go back to the judge, and then he can make a decision to abate. We would ask that this court does make an opinion on whether or not in-camera review would have been appropriate in this case. And that's simply because there was no basis to order in-camera review. The military judge ordered the trial counsel to go back and look at their notes and try and find any kind of exculpatory or Brady material. That's exactly what the trial counsel did. They went back and they said, here are some things that we think could be on the fence. We're giving it over in good faith. And lo and behold, what did the judge do? He punished them for following his order.
Now, the government arguing that in-camera review is never an appropriate option when the government is in the privilege?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. United States versus Romano certainly indicates that in-camera review, as well as some Supreme Court precedent, U.S. v. Zolan, Pennsylvania v. Ritchie, there are circumstances where in-camera review is appropriate.
The government is merely arguing that in this case, the military judge did not have a reasonable basis to issue an order.
That's correct, Your Honor, especially in light of this court's decision in the United States against Reddinghouse. And that's kind of the backstop to Romano. If you look at the language from Reddinghouse, Your Honor, I'd like to quote that. If the government had refused the disclosure of the notes at issue based on work product and had the military judge then abated the proceedings, the issue of whether the work product rule protected disclosure of interview notes in this case may have been a proper subject of appeal under Article 62 UCMJ, since the abatement would have directly resulted from the military judge's ruling concerning the applicability of the work product doctrine to potentially exculpatory material. The military judge in this case had Reddinghouse in front of him. He knew that the government could invoke, in good faith, the attorney work product privilege. And the trial counsel, again, pleaded with him to say, we want to go back and talk to our superiors to explore our appellate options pursuant to United States versus Reddinghouse. And the military judge shut that down within an hour. That's why I call it a rapid decision on his behalf. He said, and I quote, I'm saying if you don't disclose, and I'm not looking necessarily to wait to hear from what JAJM says in 24 hours or something like that either, if you don't disclose, I will dismiss or abate if that's what the defense is asking me to do. And you can certainly tell your superiors that if the defense does not withdraw their request, I will grant either an abatement or I will grant a motion to dismiss with prejudice. Again, that's on record about page 499 and at 501. And what's important about this rapid decision on behalf of the military judges, in light of the fact that the trial counsel was bending over backwards and doing everything that the military judge was asking, they were asking to speak to their superiors. And in United States versus Hornback, which is a recent decision by CAF, that's 73 MJ 155, CAF emphasizes the need for trial counsel to go back and to be able to talk to their supervisors. In fact, the discussion of Rule 1.13 of the Air Force Rules of Professional Conduct say that if a lawyer perceives a conflict between his or her professional commitments to the commander and his or her ethical obligations in the Air Force, he or she may consult with a supervisory attorney in the Air Force.
But counsel, here, once he dismissed with prejudice, you could have still done that consultation and asked him to reconsider his ruling, correct? If at that point your consultation had yielded some answer that was different than the one you've given him at the moment of dismissal.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor, but again, that's still the mere invocation of the word product privilege isn't sufficient for the military judge to say, by the way, after the fact, he doesn't say this on the record, he says it in his improper findings of fact and conclusions of law. And I say improper because under RCM 908B4, the proceedings had been stated and he did not say he was going to supplement the record. But under that, he said that it was bad faith, but there was no basis on the record to say that the invocation of the work product was bad faith. Why would it be bad faith in light of Reading House? And if you consider just this narrow remedy of the continuance, his not granting a continuance was improper. The fact that only a mere hour break did he give trial counsel to go back when their superiors in the middle of the night here at Andrews and Colonel Christensen on the West Coast weren't available to the two trial counsel, or the three trial counsel, that is just incorrect for the military judge to think that that's bad faith and not grant. He said, I'm not even going to grant a 24-hour continuance. And what's important, too, is he tries to wrap up prosecutorial misconduct in his written findings of fact and conclusions of law, but he repeatedly says, if you go back and you look at the record, he repeatedly says, I do not find prosecutorial misconduct. In fact, on page 498, that he says, I don't find prosecutorial misconduct. Four pages later, he changes his mind because they've invoked the attorney work product privilege, and he says, I find prosecutorial misconduct. I dismiss with prejudice. He was trying to bully the trial counsel, and he had lost his judicial temperament at that point, and dismissed the case improperly with prejudice.
Did you ask him at that point, though, or during the 2 weeks while he was doing his findings of fact? I understand you may not know he was doing it. But did you enlighten him at that point as to how your consultation had gone and what your plan was? One of the things we're obviously struggling with is it's been now months, and it appears you say that if we send this back, you're going to be able to appeal up to the government, I mean to the CAF, you're going to turn the notes over. So I'm trying to understand what's changed between the day he did this and now, and what the military judge knew about it, if anything.
Your Honor, nothing has changed. The proceedings had stayed. The proceedings, according to 908, had stopped on that day. And he said, he repeatedly says, I don't find intentional prosecutorial misconduct. The proceedings are stayed. Then after the fact, he says, I find bad faith. And he did that because he knew he had to justify his decision to dismiss with prejudice. Now, despite recognizing, even on the record, that some delay in the case may certainly have been due to the voluminous evidence of character that the defense provided, which they provided, by the way, late in the days coming up to the trial, which the trial counsel were trying to respond to. And we're talking about 52 witnesses, 260 pages of affidavits that they were trying to go through. And the military judge recognizes this, and yet he still says that the government was frenetic in their preparation, that they were asking for multiple continuances. None of that is on the record, Your Honor. And also, as a policy matter, we ought not let military judges supplement the record well after the fact, because trial counsel at that moment, the convening authority, had to make the decision to whether or not to appeal. And when he says after the fact it's bad faith, then we have no remedy. We have no ability to counter that.
What's the line there? When are military judges allowed to come up with written findings of fact and conclusions of law? After the fact, is there a specific time period the government is proposing that the military judge exceeded here?
We would say, Your Honor, that when the military judge says, I'm going to supplement this decision later, or supplements the decision with findings of fact and conclusions of law that are consistent with that decision, then that is permissible. But when you come in and you add extra facts and you add post hoc rationalizations for your decision, that is where it's improper. And I just want to hit the Brady disclosure, the alleged Brady disclosures here, because in-camera review was not appropriate. The reason this whole thing started, and if you look at the first 380 pages of the transcript, there is not one mention of prosecutorial misconduct. Everything's going along smoothly. The first time prosecutorial misconduct is mentioned is on page 400. Because the trial counsel, in an effort to get things done because they didn't have a lot of time, sent out that pretext phone call, and the military judge took offense to that, and he said that he actually told trial counsel to stop sending that pretext phone call out to the audience. But he found, and this is another clearly erroneous or wrong view of the law, that it would be when the affidavit said, this pretext phone call doesn't change my opinion. These consistent statements he found were, that was a Brady violation for the trial counsel not to turn it over. And that's what precipitated the whole review and the whole reason why he said, go back and look at your notes. And again, even though that was improper, trial counsel said, yes, sir, did it, looked at their notes, came back and said, out of an abundance of caution, here's some information that we have. And if you look at those statements, by the way, they're not inconsistent. If you look at the trial counsel's disclosures in Appellate Exhibit 55 on pages 4 and 5, he discusses that these witnesses did not make inconsistent statements. They said that their interpretation was that the victim had been restrained in some way, which, by the way, the allegation from the rape in 1998 was that she was restrained in some way. But anyway, they were not inconsistent statements. So that, and the military judge used that, and the fact that he thought that they were improper, that it was improper that they didn't disclose that the affiants hadn't changed their opinions, he used that to order the in-camera review. And that's why we're saying that his basis for ordering the in-camera review was improper.
Now, so what case stands for the proposition that when the military judge orders an in-camera review, the government may ignore that order simply because it disagrees with the legal basis for that order?
I think U.S. v. Reddinghouse is the case that really should concern this court. It was a very similar issue. It was an Article 62 appeal. But the difference there is, and here's the moral hazard for a trial counsel. Trial counsel in that case gave up her notes, and then after the fact realized, oh, wait a minute, I don't want to give them all up, and then tried at that point to say, we're not gonna give them up. Then it was appealed, and this court said, because you gave them over, you have no remedy. So when we're faced with a situation where a military judge may disclose all of the notes, including strategic information contained in those notes to defense counsel, and it was difficult to rely on this military judge because after they asked for his recusal, he started to rule against the government consistently. The government was concerned that they were going to turn these notes over, and there's really no standard for the military judge to use. Romano, with respect to Judge Crawford, doesn't provide a whole lot of guidance as far as when in-camera review is appropriate, under what circumstances. So again, the backstop is Reddinghouse, and Reddinghouse says, if you give those notes up, you're done, government. So the government was stuck between a rock and a hard place and had to assert that attorney work product privilege.
Does Reddinghouse say that the government has essentially lost its opportunity to pursue the issue at the moment it turns over the notes, or at the moment the judge turns over the notes to defense counsel?
I don't think it makes a distinction about that particular issue, Your Honor, but that's a good question. I think that it's the moment that the notes are turned over at that point, because then once the military judge decides that this stuff is material, I guess the only option at that point is perhaps a writ appeal.
Did the trial counsel here say that these notes contain work product? I'm just trying to figure out where all this yolanda is originating from. Besides the principle, which I understand, but sometimes the principle leads to a particular case. Did he ever say on the record, my work product and my thoughts are included in here, and I'm concerned that you're going to turn that over as opposed to the factual assertions that the witnesses might have made?
Your Honor, the record indicates the trial counsel did say work product, work product, work product. Didn't get into specifically what was in the notes because that was the entire idea why you wanted to keep, assert that particular privilege. But to say that that is bad faith merely because a prosecutor is invoking a valid, lawful privilege is incorrect. I mean, that is just blatantly incorrect. And on that ground alone, the military judge should have been should be reversed. Now, if you also look at this idea that they were somehow engaging in prosecutorial misconduct, I want to take away this notion completely, because there was no evidence of prosecutorial misconduct, potential prosecutorial misconduct, or bad faith. That is not supported by the record at all. Again, if you look at the first 400 pages, four-fifths of the records, there's not a mention of it up until Civilian Defense Counsel on page 400 says it, and that's around the time that the trial counsel had requested recusal of the military judge, because the military judge had made an opinion as to the quality of a very key important piece of evidence, and then Civilian Defense Counsel then changed the forum, withdrew the objection to the prosecution exhibit, and proceeded. But on page 446, 492, 498, and page 508, the military judge says specifically, I find no prosecutorial misconduct. So it boggles the mind to think then that he can, after the fact, come in and say, I find prosecutorial misconduct for all of these things, when he specifically told the trial counsel, I don't find it here. And at some points he says, I know you're acting in very good faith. When the phone call was sent out, actually, he says that.
How is prosecutorial misconduct and bad faith, which I believe are two different standards, how do those play into the ultimate issue here? Whether, regardless of what trial counsel's motivations were, the judge had issued an order, the government didn't comply with that order, the judge had to remedy that in some fashion. What does it matter whether or when he found prosecutorial misconduct?
It's important, Your Honor, with regard to the remedy. So when Reddinghouse indicates that the appropriate remedy, if in-camera review is justified, is abatement, and then we could appeal at that point. He skipped over abatement. His reasons for not granting an abatement were spurious, because we know that this had been changed from a member's trial to a judge-alone trial. It had been expedited. There were a number of motions that defense counsel had filed that could have stopped the trial, could have delayed the trial, the UCI motion, the motion for new 32, motion for a racially diverse panel. So the idea that an abatement would have prejudiced the accused, the same accused who thought his trial, if the motions were legitimate, his trial was going to be delayed, the idea that an abatement was going to prejudice the accused is incorrect. Now, bad faith is important, because bad faith, when you're looking at if it was truly a discovery violation that you found for dismissing with prejudice, that's an important component. It's also an important component when you're looking at whether, and I made this analogy in the brief, whether a mistrial with prejudice is appropriate. Now, if a mistrial with prejudice demands bad faith, surely a dismissal with prejudice based on prosecutorial misconduct demands the same thing. So I think that's where it comes in, Your Honor. And the military judge should have looked at all of his options. The trial counsel was even willing to stipulate to the alleged Brady violations, alleged disclosures. He was willing to stipulate to what the witnesses were going to say, delay VTC testimony, anything that would make this judge happy. But the judge skipped over all that. He skipped over a continuance. He skipped over an abatement. He skipped over dismissal without prejudice, which he incorrectly found that wasn't an option, because he thought jeopardy had attached merely because of a pre-admission of an exhibit, and jeopardy had not attached. He skipped over all that, and he did the most extreme thing. If you look at that, that's incorrect, because he only considered two options. He says it on the record, I'm only considering these two options. That is it. That is an abuse of discretion, Your Honor.
I want to go back to what I think you're describing as the pivotal moment here. Military judge has ordered trial counsel to turn over the notes for an in-camera review. Why the need for a continuance at that point? Why not merely turn over the notes for the in-camera review, use the time while the judge is reviewing them, consult with whoever trial counsel needs to consult with, and then if the military judge orders and decides to turn over the notes to defense counsel, why not pursue whatever sort of appellate options or a writ petition or whatever at that point? Why was it so important that trial counsel take the stand on this issue at that moment?
Well, Your Honor, as you know, the procedural posture of a writ appeal and an Article 62 appeal are apples and bowling balls. So if they had given the note, Reddinghouse indicates that your appellate options basically evaporate.
When was the government going to have an Article 62 appeal? on this issue.
If he had evaded the proceedings, they would have been able to have an Article 62 appeal option there as well.
Evaded proceedings for what?
For not turning the notes over as Reading House indicates, Your Honor.
So, so you're saying that the government, I still don't understand. So the government, what is the harm to turning over the notes to the military judge at that point? The privilege is not being harmed in any way, assuming there was any privileged material in there. There would still be an option to pursue whatever sort of appellate option that the government wanted to pursue at that point. How are the government's rights any less by turning it over material to the military judge?
Your Honor, at that point, the military judge could have gone through the notes and, based on his rulings up to this point, the fact that he found late 304D notice when the trial counsel were trying to merely just question witnesses for rebuttal evidence, some of the other rulings he made, the trial counsel couldn't predict how quickly or whether or not he would turn over privileged information. And once they turned it over, there was no remedy for them other than possibly a writ appeal. And this military judge specifically said, I'm not going to give you a continuance for a writ appeal. They were begging for that appellate option, and the military judge wouldn't give it to them. He gave them an hour, even though their supervisors were fast asleep in the United States.
But what are we going to make of the fact that now you say if you go back, you will turn them over? I mean, what changed? If you were willing, if you wanted to do it now, you have to do it now, why didn't you the day after, when you had the time, do it then? And tell them, we're going to turn it over. And see, maybe you would have been unreasonable in your view and said, you missed your chance, but you didn't tell him anything. And then when he issued his findings of fact, you didn't then say, well, okay, we actually reconsider this here. Here's the notes, we want to turn it over. What are we going to make of that extra time now that's passed without this option being presented to the judge or us, I guess,
either. Well, Your Honor, if the United States is going to comply with an order from a superior court directing us to, at the end of the day, or if this court orders us to do something, we're going to ultimately comply with it. The question is, though, what was the rationale? And that's why we're at the court partially here, is the rationale the military judge used to say that these notes should be turned over, that was an abuse of discretion as well.
So you're only going to comply if we say the government will turn the notes over and the judge will undismiss with prejudice. That's the only way the government will turn it over? Or if we just say, pick your example, you should have considered other options, we send it back for him to do that, and one of his options could be to say to counsel, where are you with the notes? What would the government's answer be at that point? Still be, we're not turning them over, consider your other options, and then we're going to go up on a writ appeal, but you haven't, said whether you would or not.
Yes, Your Honor, because it is his ordering of the notes was an abuse of discretion. His basis for saying, I want to look at these notes in camera, was faulty. And he never did an analysis under Brady or 701 on the record. He said, this is first-year Brady material. That's all he said.
So it seems like the standard that you're arguing for is, if the government believes that the judge will make an irresponsible ruling with regard to any privilege, that the government then can refuse a court order from the trial judge in order to secure the benefit of the 62 appeal versus the writ appeal, is that the government's position?
No, Your Honor. I think the position is that if the government thinks that there is a basis for an appeal, that they should be able to be given a continuance to at least discuss that appeal with their supervisors and then pursue that appellate option. This court should be concerned that a military judge says, I'm not going to allow you to go forward on an appellate option. He wasn't letting him go forward on that writ appeal. He shut it down. He dismissed with prejudice.
The judges do that all the time when defense say they want to take things up. And we're shocked every time that happens. We're shocked why. I mean, I understand the government here, but a lot of people want to take up the form of the daughter.
But the
delay. Not getting delays to do that.
Your Honor, the delay was merely going to be, he said, I'm not going to grant even a 24-hour delay. It would have been a short delay for them to go back and consider the options. Maybe turn over the notes, maybe not. But they wanted a delay to go back and discuss this writ appeal option. And the military judge didn't give them even that opportunity, and that was an abuse of discretion as well.
We review, as you say, this issue under the abuse of discretion standard. Military judges normally get considerable deference in managing the flow of trial proceedings. They also need considerable deference when they elect a remedy, the harm, to correct some harm. The military judge elected a remedy here, and whatever the factual basis for this conclusion, he did so because he believed that this trial needed to get moving. Doesn't the military judge normally get extreme deference under the abuse of discretion standard for those two components of his role?
He does, Your Honor. And Your Honor's decision in United States versus Seaton is a good example. There's a phenomenally of remedies that the judge has, but just because you have a discretion to do a certain remedy doesn't mean that it's proper in that particular circumstance. In Seaton, you found under RCM 703, because evidence was gone, that it couldn't come back, that the judge was proper to dismiss with prejudice. Here, you have an alleged RCM 701 violation. The government had turned everything over. There was nothing else to turn over. So
the government, we don't know because the military judge never got to review these notes.
Well, the government went back and complied with the military judge's order, and they provided this. And so the defense counsel was not prejudiced in any way because they had the information at that point. And it was an abuse of discretion for the military judge to then say, you complied with my order, so here, I'm going to punish you. I want to see the rest of your notes only because you used the out of an abundance of caution language. So that's why this is different than seeking.
How's the government punished? By any camera review of the notes.
Because this military judge has shown that he was ruling against the government repeatedly, and that if they had turned those notes over, that they would have lost any option to withhold privileged, what they considered to be privileged materials. Work, attorney work product that could have ended up in the hands of the defense counsel.
Attorney Haskell says they have a written deal. And your complaint is that you don't need automatic stay.
Which the writ appeal they couldn't pursue. They didn't even have an opportunity to pursue that because he so quickly dismissed the prejudice, Your Honor. That is the issue.
Did they ask the judge, if we give these to you now, are you going to immediately turn something over, or we have time, if we decide to turn something over, to see what you plan to turn over, and to decide whether we think any work product privilege is implicated by those appointments?
I would ask this court to look at the last 15 pages of the record. The trial counsel actually was pleading with the military judge. I don't know exactly how this process works. I'm just trying to get this right. And the military judge dismissed with prejudice, Your Honor, and I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Shore, and along with my co-counsel, Professor Wells, we represent Chief Master Sergeant Roy Bowser. There is truly only one question that is before the court, and that is whether the military judge dismissed with prejudice was an abuse of discretion. Stated simply, it was not. His actions were well within the range of possible remedies. His findings of fact were not clearly erroneous, nor were his conclusions of law incorrect. As the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces recently stated in United States v. Ritz, the abuse of discretion standard calls for more than a mere difference of opinion. The challenged action must be arbitrary, clearly unreasonable, or clearly erroneous. Deference must be given to the military judge's decision, and all evidence must be viewed in the light most favorable to the prevailing party. To address first the time the government had to seek the appeal and discuss with their superiors the order to provide the notes for the in-camera review. The military judge gave them multiple opportunities over the course of nearly 36 hours to consult with their leadership and develop their appellate course of action. His initial request for the notes was made on 3 June. You can see that at Appellate Exhibit 55. The dismissal did not occur until 4 June. He gave them multiple opportunities throughout the record to explain on 4 June. He gave them over an hour to consult with their superiors. But again, if you look back to Appellate Exhibit 55, their response to the military judge's initial request for the notes stated, we have discussed this with our superiors and JJG. We will not turn over the notes. They'd been discussing this issue with their superiors and with JJG for 36 hours. They were aware of it and had plenty of time to seek a writ appeal of the military judge's order to turn over those notes. Yet they just stood there and steadfastly refused. The government chose not to write, to take that appeal. Government was well aware of the possibility to take a writ appeal, as on page 499 of the record, trial counsel specifically states the potential of seeking extraordinary relief. It was the government's choice not to appeal that decision, but to simply refuse the military judge's order. Because they chose not to appeal the order to turn over the notes, as the government pointed out, we're in a Rittenhouse type situation. The military judge was forced to make a decision to maintain control over his courtroom. He chose dismissal with prejudice. There is nothing incorrect or an abuse of discretion about that decision. It's the government's failure to appeal the military judge's decision that puts us here, and the government is asking the court to answer a question that's not for you. Whether or not the military judge's order to produce the notes was proper is not a question that this court can answer at this point, because the government didn't appeal it. Just as this court stated in Rittenhouse, when the government does not appeal the decision to produce the order, the government cannot ask this court to later evaluate whether or not that order was proper. The only decision they appealed was whether the military judge abused his discretion in dismissing with prejudice.
Isn't that issue part and parcel of what the government did appeal? I mean, I recognize the words, you know, military judge's order were not contained in the framed issue, but trial counsel didn't turn over the notes. We didn't go to that next step.
Absolutely, Your Honor. It's part and parcel of it, but it's among many other things that were involved in the military judge's decision to dismiss with prejudice. It's one piece of that decision. What the government's doing now is they're asking you to just render a decision on whether or not the judge should have ordered that the notes turned over. That's not the question. Just as in Rittenhouse, when this court stated, if you appeal that decision, we can answer that question. But because the military judge chose dismissal with prejudice for a number of reasons, the question before the court is only whether the dismissal with prejudice was appropriate, not appropriate, whether it was an abuse of discretion, not whether the turning over the notes was proper. The military judge asked trial counsel and the government to turn over their ink notes for the in-camera review, and that's in compliance with clear, lackluster law, nearly 30 years of precedent from both this court and the Superior Court. In 1997, CAP issued its decision in the United States v. Romano, which is directly on point, and CAP's direction is unquestionable. The military judge is to review the notes in camera prior to decision on whether or not they're discoverable. The rationale is clear. It's because the privilege rules limit the truth-finding ability and exclude legally relevant evidence. Therefore, federal courts do not favor them, and they would rather balance the needs and the interests of all those involved. The statements here were inconsistent statements, and they could have benefited the defense. The fact that the government was unable to evaluate those and turn those over prior to the judge telling them to review their notes is what caused the military judge to lose faith in the government's ability.
What's the standard for Brady legal material? You just said it could have benefited the defense.
Absolutely.
Is that the standard?
No, Your Honor, I apologize. It's material. Anything material or exculpatory. Inconsistent statements are included within that, specifically under Bagley. They state that inconsistent statements can be material to the defense and therefore should be turned over, just as all other Brady material, exculpatory and otherwise.
So you're a fact finder. I recognize that you're saying that this isn't part of the issue, but we're discussing it. If you're the fact finder, the fact that two witnesses who had talked to the alleged victim have some memory about her being tied down or restrained is a material fact in that issue. Regardless of the fact they don't remember how they got that impression or whether she said it, that is a central fact that the determination of guilt or innocence is going to revolve around?
There's two responses to that, Your Honor. First and foremost, there were no other inconsistent statements in this complaining witness's testimony. Throughout all of her prior proceedings, all of her prior testimony, she had never given an inconsistent statement. The defense was specifically seeking those if they existed. What these were, both witnesses had talked to the complaining witness and had some impression that she left them with, that there was a different version of events out there, That was absolutely central, and the defense had an absolute right to present that to the fact finder simply because it could create a reasonable doubt in their mind. It is material in a potential inconsistency upon which they could challenge the complaining witness's testimony. Moreover, in the trial counsel's initial disclosure in Appellate Exhibit 55, with regard to Master Sergeant Schneider, he does not say that she was not sure if the witness told her this. He specifically says the witness did tell her this. It is not until the judge challenges him on that all of a sudden it changes to, well, that's just the impression she got. She wasn't really sure. It's all of a sudden equivocating. The statement's initial disclosure was that the complaining witness told Master Sergeant Schneider a different version of events than she testified to up until that point. That is why they are material, and the defense had the right to have them disclosed, to just explore those with the complaining witnesses, and potentially present them to the fact finder. The evidence under Brady, Giglio, Kyles, Bagley does not have to be admissible in order to be discoverable. That is the key factor here. Whether or not the defense was even going to use them is not the question. The question is whether or not they were material, inconsistent statements the defense was entitled to assist in their preparation.
The defense was aware of these witnesses already through something?
The defense was not aware of at least one of the witnesses, Your Honor. One of the witnesses was not disclosed, I believe it was Master Sergeant Schneider, was not disclosed to the defense at any point in any pretrial investigation until 2 days prior to trial.
Trial counsel turned over the material. Now, they included some qualifying language in that the military judge found problematic.
Yes, sir.
But they turned over the material. Would you agree this is at least different from the normal kind of Brady or Giglio 701 kind of case where the material isn't turned over and we only learn about it while the case is pending appeal?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It is very different than your typical Brady case. Normally, in almost every Brady case that you review is through conducting research in this case, you'll find every Brady violation seems to occur post the fact of the trial. What we're dealing with here is a military judge attempting to secure a confident verdict prior to the trial because of concerns of Brady violations leading up to the trial.
I'll ask you the same question I asked the government. What are we to make of the fact that if we send it back, I think maybe for any reason, the government's willing to turn over the notes? Or maybe they're only willing to turn it over if we ourselves order it to be turned over. What are we to make of that, the passage of time that's elapsed since the judge initial decision?
Your Honor, I think it's interesting that the government's position is now that they would be willing to turn over the notes, or that they would only be willing to turn over the notes if this court were to order it. A military judge's order is a military judge's order, and the importance of following a military judge's order is tantamount, found even in our standards for criminal justice. You can find that requirement at standard 3-5.2. Regardless of who orders it, the government's refusal to comply with the order is the key here. And the fact that their position has now changed is telling because the case law is clear. The providing notes for an in-camera inspection is appropriate, correct? And exactly what the military judge should have ordered. This court has supported that just twice in the last 4 years, has supported that very position. So the fact that the government has now changed and decided that they would turn over the notes is telling that their refusal was not proper, and therefore goes even further to show that the military judge did not abuse his discretion in dismissing with prejudice because his findings that the government's position was done in bad faith was correct.
So if that outcome was so inevitable, was it an abuse of discretion not to give the government 24 hours to consider whether that was really what they were going to do?
It was not an abuse of discretion, Your Honor, because he'd already given them the 36 hours. As we discussed earlier, June 3rd was that initial request. The government had the opportunity to consult with their superiors, discuss their appellate course of action, and they chose not to. They chose not to exceed that extraordinary writ that they knew well that they could. They just said, we're not going to comply with your order without any just cause or justification.
Do you agree with what Cush came to show? The military judge's belief that the government was intentionally seeking a delay to prepare for trial drove the military judge's decision to dismiss the charges and specifications rather than order an abatement.
I think that was one of the factors, Your Honor. I do not believe the military judge decided one particular thing mattered more to him than the other when making his decision to dismiss with prejudice. What's interesting about this case is that the military judge could have dismissed with prejudice for just the Brady violation, for just the prosecutorial misconduct issue, for just the refusal to comply with his order. He could have dismissed with prejudice for any one of those things. It was the collection of activities, the collection of misconduct that took him to the place where he eventually dismissed with prejudice. The military judge, throughout the record, was attempting to correct the conduct, to control the courtroom, and control the conduct of counsel. He moved along in the spectrum. He took the opportunity to limit the use of evidence by the government, to expand the military rules of evidence to allow the defense counsel for additional questions that normally wouldn't be allowed. He ordered the production of documents by the trial counsel. He did a number of things in order to try to move this case along and secure a fair trial. It was only the government's continued refusal to follow his orders and to comply with the rules that eventually brought him to that position where he decided dismissal with prejudice was the most appropriate remedy.
Military judge found time after time that he had not yet reached the threshold of prosecutorial misconduct, right up until the point where the government needs to turn over their notes. How are we to decide whether or not those are two separate distinctions, or is the prosecutorial misconduct simply the refusal to follow court's orders?
The military judge, throughout his ruling, lists a number of reasons why he found the prosecutorial misconduct eventually. And I think as you look at the record, you can see that he was hesitant to get to that point. His hesitancy to get to the prosecutorial misconduct just shows how long and how carefully he deliberated.
So we should view that as reconsideration. His ultimate written ruling, we should view that as reconsideration of his previous finding that he had not yet found prosecutorial misconduct?
Actually, Your Honor, if you look to page 508, despite the government's assertion, on page 508 of the record, the military judge finds prosecutorial misconduct. His written ruling is, in fact, on all major points that this court needs to make a decision, completely consistent with everything he found in the record of trial on the day of the decision. The prosecutorial misconduct decision was at page 508 into paragraph 37 of the ruling. His desire to create precedent, or his belief that the government had a desire to create precedent or to avoid it, page 507 of the transcript, paragraphs 34 to 36. The fact that he lost faith in the ability of the government to evaluate grading material, page 505, 506, also at paragraphs 30, 31, and 38. I can go on, Your Honor, but the consistency is
clear. I guess my question, and forgive me for not being able to go back to pages in the record,
yes,
aren't all of those subsequent to the government's refusal to turn over their notes?
Everything was both his findings on the day of and his written ruling, Your Honor, were all subsequent to the government's refusal, absolutely. The prosecutorial misconduct issue, though, encompasses a number of things. And I think the military judge, if you review the record, the military judge took the time to get there. He continued to say, I'm not there yet, I'm not there yet. It was only the factors that continued to pile up and pile up and the government's continued refusal to follow the orders and the rules that got him to the eventual finding of prosecutorial misconduct based on his written ruling and what he stated on the record that day.
I take it the defense agrees with the military judge that in his finding or in his speculation, however you want to term it, that the government was intentionally seeking a delay to prepare for trial. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that based on the number of continuance requests that appear on the record and those that were noted that occurred on record, that we believe that the government may have made a request in their refusal.
So you get to see my next question. Assuming that was a matter that it was played already here, what facts could support that? Delaying 3D and 4 happens from time to time in the trial, particularly when the procedural posture changes.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
We know that there were late witness notices, which happens in court martial preparation. We know that the government did successfully seek a continuance for less than 2 days to deal with about 250 pages of newly provided material. And we know that the government sought a continuance of some indeterminate length, presumably anywhere between a few hours to 24 hours to consult on this issue.
Yes, sir.
Are those the only matters in the record that support the military judge's sense of the government's motivations here?
I will note, Your Honor, at page 383, 421, 430, 433, 438 to 440, 497, 499, 500, and 502, the government requests continuance. At page 421 specifically, it's noted by the counsel and the military judge that the government has repeatedly requested continuances and delays off record via emails and during 802 sessions. Additionally, I note the affidavits that were provided to the government, they're characterized by the government throughout the proceedings in here today as late notices. What was apparent on the record is that those witnesses were actually provided to the government 10 months prior to the Article 32 hearing, and these notices of those witnesses and a significant number of character letters. They were re-identified to the government, all the witnesses, on May 13th. It was only the affidavits that were provided a few days prior to trial. Those were the only, that was the, just their actual testimony in and of itself. The witnesses were known to the government for almost a month before the, proceedings. When you take all of that into consideration, additionally, you take into consideration pages 438 and 440, trial counsel's assertion that he could start the case whenever he wanted because it was his case and he felt that he needed more time to prepare. All those go into the military judge's decision that the trial counsel and the government needed more time and were willing to do whatever they could to get additional time to prepare.
The military judge made a number of observations in his written ruling about the harm, the prejudice that occurred by virtue of a continuance in this case. What do we make of the government's assertion that had the defense motion been granted, there would have been a delay in any of them?
That assertion is interesting, Your Honor, because what's apparent from the record, especially after the government indicated their notice of 62 appeal or the ruling on the pretext phone call, the defense immediately chose to waive that objection to the actual pretext phone call, to allow that evidence in, evidence that could potentially, that they just fought so hard to keep out, just so they could proceed to trial.
But I guess my question is, when we weigh whether or not the judge's finding of prejudice was fairly supported by the record, one of the things we'll look at is whether you consider facts adverse to just one party or for both parties. And the defense's point, or the government rather, has pointed out that the defense had made a number of requests that, had the judge granted them, would have resulted in exactly the kind of delay that the trial counsel asked for.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think when you use the fact that they withdrew their objection, you can see that perhaps had any of those other motions been granted, the defense may have stepped back and said strategically, we want this case to go to trial more than we want these motions. That's hard to say at this point.
Yeah, I guess my question isn't so much of a trial strategy standpoint. My question is, when the judge talked about prejudice, he talked about prejudice that occurred simply by virtue of delay. The cost of counsel traveling back and forth to Europe, the stress that the appellant would be under. All of those things relate to a delay, and yet the defense, had their motion been granted, that delay would have been inevitable.
Understood, Your Honor. That is correct. But I think that when the military judge took that was making his decision, it was after the fact of the withdrawal of objection. And so his new view of the defense's new position at that point was simply they wanted to proceed to trial regardless of what occurred. Well, you're correct, the delay would have happened if the defense had prevailed. This was a new position. Given the defense's change of posture post the withdrawal of the objection, there fervence for a speedy trial became even more apparent. They were doing just about everything they could to get to trial. I want to get to trial. We want to get to trial. We want no delay whatsoever. And then the military judge took those actions into consideration in that the defense's position had become even more aggressive with regard to the speedy trial, and that's why it would cause prejudice to Chief Bowser. Additionally, though, when looking at the prejudice, we can't ignore the potential for a non-fair trial. If there is outstanding Brady material, the lack of confidence in any verdict that would be reached, whether it's conviction or acquittal, without a review of these notes, there is no confidence in the verdict. And that plays a significant role into the prejudice to Chief Bowser.
Wasn't the best way to secure a review of the Brady material for the judge to give a little time to the government to come to the realization that you characterize as somewhat inevitable, that they ought to turn to their notes? Would that 24-hour delay have been a great way to get to review that material?
Well, it could have, Your Honor. I believe that the military judge's consideration at that point from the record was that he'd given them over 36 hours. They consulted with their superiors, and there was no additional need to continue to pursue these appellate courses of action. The Romano decision had been cited for days at that point. trial counsel themselves cited United States v. Zolin. They were well aware of the case law, of the precedent, and they simply chose to refuse without justification in light of full knowledge of the case law out there.
You would agree that dismissal with prejudice is an extreme remedy?
Yes, Your Honor.
Certainly not an ideal one, not one that serves the interests of the government or the alleged victim in this case. Trying to nail down what the defense's position makes dismissal with prejudice a more appropriate remedy than abatement or dismissal without prejudice. One of the facts we discussed is the military judge's impression of the government's motivations. Beyond that, what makes the chosen remedy the more appropriate one?
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with the style of the question. I do not believe that it is the court is not answering whether it was the most appropriate or the most correct option. In fact, as Your Honor recently stated in United States v. DiMario, this court could disagree entirely with what the judge did. If you had been sitting on the bench, you would not have made that same decision. That does not mean
DiMario is a writ appeal, so it's a writ petition.
Yes, it was, Your Honor, absolutely. And I'm simply pointing out that you, as a sitting military judge, could make a different decision. That does not mean that the military judge here abused his discretion. And so whether it was the most appropriate remedy or not, it is not necessarily the question.
The military judge is, though, required to analyze alternative options short of dismissal with prejudice, correct?
He absolutely is, Your Honor, and he did in his written ruling. He specifically went through each alternative option and why it was not appropriate in this case.
And I'm trying to understand what's the defense's position as to what, under that analysis, makes dismissal with prejudice the more appropriate remedy?
Your Honor, the reason dismissal with prejudice was more appropriate is because any other option would have been either a windfall to the government or given them exactly what they sought.
Which goes back to the fact that we discussed before, which you said was a factor in the military judge's choice of remedy, but perhaps not the dispositive factor.
Absolutely, Your Honor. It is a factor and one he considered. In looking at each remedy, he carefully analyzed what is the best thing to do. How would this help the accused? How would this correct the problem? Does this hurt the complaining witness? And he recognized in dismissing with prejudice that it was not, it precluded both the complaining witness and the accused from their day in trial. And it was definitely not the preferred option. But when he evaluated carefully each of the other options, there was nothing left that he felt would correct the misconduct and carefully and address and not be a windfall to the government at the same time. Replacement of trial counsel would not have worked because the trial counsel would have gotten continuance, which is exactly what he felt the government wanted. Additionally, there was no one on the government's team. The government had spoken up all the way up their functional chain of command, their superiors and JHAG. No one was willing to turn over the notes. Sanctions or contempt would not be appropriate, as they already demonstrated they weren't willing to follow the military judge's order. Abatement and dismissal with prejudice were effectively the same thing, and they would not have allowed Chief Bowser a fair trial. They would have just continued to delay the issue. They would have, it would not have reached the point where the military judge could secure confidence in the verdict. And at that point, there was nothing the military judge understood was going to change. The government had offered over the course of 36 hours no difference of opinion. They never intended to change course. A new trial would again not afford Chief Bowser a fair trial. Until those notes are reviewed for potential breaking material, we have no way of having confidence in the verdict.
You characterize it as a 36-hour period. The trial counsel was on notice of this issue and had time to consult with JHAG.
Yes, sir.
What did trial counsel know in that 36 hours? The military judge told them basically have the notes ready, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that's what the email says.
We don't know. He certainly had ordered them to produce the notes for an in-camera review at that point, correct?
Not a specific order, no, Your Honor.
He hadn't discussed
what the consequences might be if the government failed to comply with an eventual order, right?
That's correct.
So it was really only the morning of where trial counsel realized that A, there was an order, and B, there was going to be some sort of significant remedy for failure to comply with that order.
Yes, sir.
Isn't it reasonable that to view that the posture had changed somewhat at that point, and perhaps trial counsel should have one more opportunity to consult on that issue?
Your Honor, given that trial counsel had already consulted, the military judge had been leading up to this throughout some of their discussion. The defense counsel had previously suggested it, and in fact, trial counsel had already provided their votes to the military judge for an in-camera review and withdrawn that on the advice, according to them, of their superiors at J and JJG. So leading up to this, this issue was bubbling up over the course of a number of days.
But it's conceivable to me that supervisory counsel would have said, don't do it until the court orders you to.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. And at that point, trial counsel still didn't do it.
And but then the trial counsel would have gone back to the supervisory attorneys in a substantially different posture. Sir, the court had not ordered it. Has your opinion changed?
Yes, Your Honor, they could have.
And they didn't have an opportunity to have that discussion with their superiors who were in a substantially different time zone.
Yes, Your Honor. However, the government still had the opportunity leading up to this point to discuss all eventualities. We're talking a number over the course of 2 days to discuss all eventualities. What if he orders it and we can't get a hold of you? What are we supposed to do if he orders it? Moreover, this case does not belong to JAJG. This case belongs to the convening authority. The convening authority's SJAs were available readily. In fact, they testified at these proceedings. They could have sought the advice of the supervising attorneys for the person that this case belonged to.
What did the trial counsel want the delay to discuss? What were they going to discuss? Appellate options, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
The convening authority has no power to authorize a writ petition or an Article 60 kill.
He does not, Your Honor. However, they have all, given that they spent so much time talking to JAJG, you take that into consideration with the fact that the military, that they had access to the convening authorities, attorneys, supervising lawyers. Those combined show that the government had sufficient time to seek their appellate options and to make a decision as to what exactly they wanted to do.
What was the paralegal's testimony relative to these 36 hours?
The paralegal's testimony, Your Honor, was the morning of June 4th, was the last part leading up to the order to disclose the notes. Finally, Your Honor, although, as we discussed slightly, although not needed, the military judge's finding that the trial counsel refused to comply with black letter law and all misconduct is not needed for this court. I see I've run out of time, if I may briefly conclude.
Sure.
We are not going to comply with your order. Trial counsel's words after significant other misconduct. To quote the government's standard of review, the military judge's findings of fact are reasonable and his conclusions of law are correct. He did not abuse his discretion. This court should affirm his decision. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to disabuse this court of a few notions. Number one, we've appealed the entire ruling of the military judge, including the ruling on whether or not the camera review was appropriate, whether or not the invocation of the work product privilege was appropriate. Now, I also want to discuss this 36 hours. It wasn't until the end of that 36 hours that the trial counsel even gave over the material that prompted the in-camera reviews. The military judge had not ordered it at that point. So to say that somehow they had the ability to contact their supervisors within that 36 hours is incorrect. Also, in Appellate Exhibit 55, on pages 4 and 5, I implore this court to look at those two statements. That is the disclosure the trial counsel makes. You will not find an inconsistent statement there. Trial counsel makes clear that the witnesses clarified that they did not hear an inconsistent statement. And in fact, it is consistent with what the alleged rape was in 1998, that she was restrained in some way. So there weren't inconsistent statements on behalf of the alleged victim. So I also want to go through the erroneous findings of fact that the military judge.
Real quick on your statement, you're appealing all of them. certainly some part of that is appealable under Article 62. Are you suggesting that once you have a basis that is appealable under 62, we can consider all those other issues?
Your Honor, I think that because he used all of those justifications to base his decision, that's all before this court, Your Honor. Just quickly, I'm going to go through the erroneous findings of fact of the military judge. Number one, and I quote, I'm quoting the appellate exhibit 59, a government request for a continuance was made several times in the record. And I know that appellate counsel also pointed out several page numbers. The truth is there were only two continuances. One of them was granted for 36 hours, and the second one was merely to talk to their supervisory attorneys. Quote, it is the opinion of this court that the government was still perfecting its case, that the failure to perfect its case the previous 10 months was without good cause, then any delay would inure to its benefit. Again, that's paragraph 16 of Appellate Exhibit 59. The court finds there is a significant possibility that unrevealed Brady material remains in the government's possession. Again, no basis whatsoever on the record to say this. By hijacking the case of U.S. v. Bowser for other means, the government has denied a timely resolution of this matter for both Chief Bowser and the victim in this case. Again, not based on any kind of fact in the record. The military judge's judicial temperament failed him when he hastily dismissed these very serious charges with prejudice. By exercising his self-proclaimed nuclear option based on an erroneous view of the facts of law, and by finding prosecutorial misconduct where there was none, the military judge acted well outside of his discretion, and his ruling should therefore be reversed. Both appellee and Senior Master Sergeant A.B. deserve their day in court, and this court now has an opportunity to ensure for both sides that justice be done.
I need to go back to the pivotal moment again where trial counsel decides not to comply with the military judge's order, not to turn over the evidence. What I hear the government's position on this issue is the harm that the government was protecting against was twofold. One, that they didn't trust that the military judge would treat that material appropriately. And two, they were concerned if they do so that their appellate options might be more limited. In that respect, they might only have writ petition versus Article 62 appeal. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the second prong of that is based entirely on U.S. v. Reddinghouse from this court, where, again, I said that was the backstop to Romano, because there is no clear definition out there, unlike U.S. v. Zolan, which talks about crime fraud, talks about a specific standard. When should you be able to release? There is no standard to determine when in-camera review is appropriate. So the military judge, if we had turned this over based on Reddinghouse, we would have lost all options. But again, the important point is here, we never got to discuss that particular issue because the military judge would not grant the continuance. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for those excellent and interesting arguments, and the court will issue a decision in due course.
All rise.